Well, what drives a person to kill? Murder and its motives is a classic of criminology. I wonder if any of you have seen it. It's 90 years old this year. And in that book, criminologist F. Tennyson Jesse divides murderers into six different categories according to the motivation that they have for murder. So there's those who murder for gain, those who murder for revenge, elimination, jealousy, conviction, and the sixth one, don't have enough fingers, is lust of killing. Now, this classification of murder motive has remained influential. And I guess we know, don't we, that there's a connection between the act of murder and the motive that lies behind it. That's why it's so important in a court of law to establish the motive for murder. But our legal system draws a line between the murder and its motive. So, of course, it's a crime to commit murder, but it's not a crime, of course, innocently to just have a motive for murder, nor is it a crime to be jealous or to be vengeful. It's not even a crime to have a lust for killing. I wonder if you've seen the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report. It's 10 or 12 years old now. But in that movie, the technique of so-called pre-crime allows the police to tell whether a motive for murder in advance will actually lead to a murder being committed. So they can get to the scene of the crime, well, this is the idea, just in time, and stop the murder happening. But the person who would have committed the murder, the would-be perpetrator, is still guilty. Now, I guess most of us like the idea of being able to stop murders if we could. But we get uncomfortable at the idea that somebody would be guilty if they hadn't actually committed a crime. And that makes sense. We know that we can't judge the heart. But you know, God can. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus Christ, God's appointed judge, begins the process of judging the human heart. You'll remember, if you were here last week, how Jesus, in this section of the Sermon on the Mount, is relating himself to the Old Testament law. And he says how he's come to uphold it and even to fulfill it in his own person. Remember how James explained that Jesus said he would take the law, which the teachers of his day had kind of shriveled or deflated down to a manageable size, and fill it back up again so that they'd see it in its beauty and its glory. Well, here's what Jesus says in a nutshell in this chapter. If we're ever to enter the kingdom of heaven, we must have a righteousness that surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. This kind of righteousness is deep. It flows from the heart, and it comes from God. It's the exact opposite of the righteousness of the Pharisees. Shallow, only surface deep, and man-made. And in today's passage, Jesus begins the first of six examples of what this true righteousness looks like, so that we can see it in practice. Each time, he picks up some part of the Jewish tradition, and he says, "You've heard that it was said, such and such." And then he says, with quintessential authority, "But I tell you." Now, as we heard last week, Jesus is not offering anything essentially new here. He's not contradicting Moses, who wrote down the Old Testament, but rather popular or clerical distortions of the law of God that were going around in Jesus' own day. They'd separated the law from the heart attitudes that it was always meant to address. And so Jesus gives a radical reaffirmation that the law of God extends beyond the external to the internal and the invisible. Beyond the enacted to the conceived. Beyond the fruit to the root. Beyond the hands and feet to the mind and the heart. And in doing so, we're going to see that Jesus leads us into, first of all, a redefinition of sin. Second, a redefinition of righteousness. And as we look at those in turn, I want us to see, finally, that Jesus, on the basis of these definitions, urges us in the strongest possible terms to be reconciled to God. So we've got a redefinition of sin, a redefinition of righteousness, and the urge to be reconciled. Let's think first about this redefinition of sin in verses 21 and 22. Now, by most people's standards, I'm not a murderer. I've never killed anyone. I'm not a violent person. I don't like fighting. The closest that, well, I did once punch somebody in the face. That happened when I was at school, and we were doing a chemistry experiment. I think we were heating up some molten magnesium in one of these crucible things to see it light up, or whatever chemists do. And my friend knocked my experiment on the floor, and it burned a hole in the ground. So I punched him in the face. I thought he should have got the detention, but I got a detention. Anyway, that's the full extent of my career of violence. Confessions out. But by Jesus' standards, I have the heart of a murderer. And that makes me guilty before God. Have a look with me at what Jesus says in verse 21, if you've still got your Bible open. That's page 969. You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. Now, this is the law of God. We looked at the Ten Commandments earlier. They're up on the wall over there. The people had heard it 1,400 years before when God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses at Mount Sinai. And the subjection to judgment of a murderer goes back even further to the book of Genesis. So in Genesis chapter 4, Cain kills his brother Abel, and is subjected to God's judgment. A few chapters later on, in chapter 9, human judgment of murderers is prescribed for the descendants of Noah. So yeah, the people had heard this. They'd heard it week by week in their synagogue services. But Jesus, with all the authority of God's anointed prophet and king, reaffirms the law's application to the heart. But I tell you, that anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. The all-encompassing nature of what Jesus is saying is meant to strike us. Brother or sister in this context just means anyone. Anyone who's angry with anyone. It couldn't get more wide, all-encompassing than that. You see then how sin is not just committing crimes. If you're from China or Japan or maybe some other places, I don't know. Your word for sin is the same as your word for crime. But we can't get those two things confused. You see how Jesus is talking about something far more deep, far more internal than just committing visible crimes. Anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. It sounds so all-encompassing that you can see that some early scribe who copied the New Testament, Matthew's Gospel, couldn't believe that Jesus had really said it like that. Surely you could imagine him thinking there must be some good types of anger. We could think of righteous anger. You know, the kind of anger you feel when you're watching that football match and the ref gets it wrong again. But we're not mentioning football. Have a look at footnote C in verse 22. And you'll see that some manuscripts of Matthew, in fact, most of the manuscripts we've still got today, include the words, without cause. Anyone who's angry with his brother or sister without cause, that makes it easy, doesn't it? If you've got a cause, it's all right. But these words aren't in the oldest and the best manuscripts of Matthew. They were almost certainly added in later on. Jesus goes on. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. If you're anything like me, you read this and you're thinking, okay, Jesus, you've got me on the getting angry bit, but I've never said raka to anyone. And okay, because raka is Aramaic, and I don't speak Aramaic. But look it up in the dictionary, and what do you find? Raka, a term of abuse, or a put-down relating to lack of intelligence. Idiot, fool, with the effect of verbal bullying. 12-year-old Rebecca Ann Sedwick committed suicide in autumn last year. You might have read about it or seen it in the news. She was a victim of cyberbullying. sustained internet-based abuse by 15 other kids in her school, who bombarded her with text messages, abusive text messages, that drove her to despair and ultimately to her death. It's a tragic story, and sadly one that we're seeing more and more the like of. But it reminds us of a truth that I think is often forgotten in our internet age. Words, whether we speak them or type them or text them, have consequences. Maybe our culture is slowly relearning this lesson that words have consequences. So so-called hate speech has been criminalized by legislation. Or some of these internet trolls, you know, the people who post abusive and defamatory things in internet chat rooms, have actually been prosecuted for the things that they've written. Well, Jesus, once again here, extends the connection right back to the most innocuous-sounding term of abuse. When we say such things to others, Jesus says we're worthy of judgment. Well, what have you said? What have you thought about other people? That word translated, you fool, gives us the English word moron. It's a term of contempt. And such contempt of others, Jesus says, puts us in danger of the fire of hell. The original says Gehenna. It was an actual place, a valley just south of the city wall of Jerusalem where a perpetual fire burned the rubbish. But in the Gospels, it stands as a kind of figure for the place of punishment after death. Hell. Church Bible says we're in danger of the fire of hell. It sort of makes it sound a bit like what I say to my kids, you know, tidy up your room or you're in danger of losing your pocket money. But the original is much stronger than that. Whoever says you fool is quite guilty enough that he or she will go into the fire of hell. Now, I don't need to press this to make the point that Jesus is making. It's quite clear, isn't it? We're all guilty by Jesus' standard. We all deserve judgment, now in this life, and eternally in a place of punishment. This is serious stuff. But I guess some still might feel at this point that Jesus hasn't established the necessary connection between murder and motive. Isn't it possible, after all, to say you fool to someone, but not actually want to kill them? Or isn't it better, if you are going to hate someone, to hate them with a passion, but not actually pull out a knife and stab them? Well, the Pharisees thought so. That's why they felt they could keep the law by keeping it externally. But in doing so, they missed the very point where Jesus wanted to press them, the heart. I wonder if this is where modern criminology can help us. Do you remember those categories of murder motive that I began with this evening? I think three of them particularly speak exactly into this kind of situation that Jesus is talking about. Revenge, elimination, and jealousy. Here's what I mean. Revenge says, I want to get him back, so I hate him. Elimination says, I want her out of the way, so I hate her. And jealousy says, I want what she's got, so I hate her. You see how any of these could result in the anger or abuse or contempt of which Jesus is speaking. And they're all, criminology tells us, and Jesus tells us, ultimately, motives for murder. Now, there's a memorable phrase in the Psalms where people are described as being pregnant with evil. Pregnant with evil. And I wonder if that's not us. We're pregnant with evil. We might not give birth to murder physically for lack of opportunity or lack of ability or some other physical or social or mental constraint that stops us actually carrying it through. But we're conceiving murder all the time. That's how sin works. So we need a redefinition of sin. I, Richard, have the heart of a murderer, says Jesus Christ. And so do you. The Apostle John goes one further. Not just the heart of a murderer, he says, but anyone who hates a brother or sister is a murderer. We're guilty. Well, second, Jesus gives us not just a redefinition of sin, but a redefinition of righteousness. As we go through the Sermon on the Mount, we find that there are two different kinds of righteousness in view. One is Pharisaic righteousness, and the other one is true righteousness, God's righteousness, for want of a better term. And they're contrasting. Pharisaic righteousness is strongly transactional in nature, tit for tat. It says, love your friends and hate your enemies. Pay your dues to God and keep out of trouble. And as I've been thinking about it, I wonder if Pharisaic righteousness is not actually pretty similar to what our culture holds up as values of so-called righteousness. Yeah, we've removed the reference to God for the most part. But it goes like this, doesn't it? Do what's expected of you. Yeah. Do what you can to help out others who might be able to give you a help up in the future. But everyone else, well, they're not relevant to you. You can forget about them. Now, Jesus has said, remember from last week, that we need a very different kind of righteousness. A righteousness that surpasses the righteousness of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. Otherwise, we'll certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Later in the chapter, in verse 48, we have to be perfect. A perfection that reflects our Father in heaven, so that we're like God. And in verses 23 and 24, the next couple in today's section, Jesus gives us a positive example of what this true righteousness looks like. And it's so different from Pharisaic righteousness. Let me read those verses again, 23 and 24. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Now, I want us, first of all, to notice who's got the problem here. Who's got the problem? We'll look down and see if you can work it out. It's not the person that Jesus addresses as you. No, it's someone else. It's your brother or sister. So there's no indication that the individuals Jesus is addressing as you have any problem or anything against their brother or sister. It's the brother or sister who's got something against them. Now, what does Pharisaic righteousness do in this kind of situation? What's the teacher of the law retort to Jesus here? What's his problem? It's nothing to do with me. She's the one who's all bitter about it and can't let go of it. It's not my issue. Jesus turns the whole thing on its head. If a brother or sister has something against you, it's up to you to do something about it. You need to seek reconciliation, because that's a characteristic of true righteousness. Romans 12:18 makes a similar point when it says, if it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. See how true righteousness is different? Now, it's significant that Jesus situates this little scene in the context of giving a gift at the temple. Significant for two reasons, I think. First of all, if you're going to be righteous, this shows, you've got to be reconciled before you can be religious. If you're going to be righteous, you've got to be reconciled before you can be religious. See, coming to church can't compensate for neglected relationships. The Bible makes that clear. There's no amount of praying and coming to services and doing Christian things that can compensate for an evil heart. There's a right order to these things. Do what you can to right wrongs, to clear up misunderstandings, to apologize for any hurt you might have caused, and then come and offer your gifts to God. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I think locating this scene in the temple shows that if you're going to be righteous, reconciliation is more important than even the most important other things that you might do. Let me explain what I mean. If you're a Jewish person, going to offer a gift to God at the temple is one of the most important things you do in your daily life. It's not daily life, it's special. Let's say you'd heard this sermon of Jesus up in Galilee. It's an 80-mile journey to get to Jerusalem where the temple is. You'd have to go presumably on foot, unless you ride a little donkey. When you get to Jerusalem, you've got to climb up to the Temple Mount, buy the goat or the lamb if you've not brought it all the way with you from Galilee. And then presumably queue up in a long line of people who are all waiting to get to the altar where the priest is ready to slaughter it and offer it up to God as a gift for you. Now, you could be excused, couldn't you, if it got to that point where it was your turn in the queue and then something popped into your head about some relationship. At that moment, for saying, well, all right, okay, I've come all this way from Galilee to Jerusalem. I'm just going to get on with the offering the gift up to God or whatever it is, and then I'll go and deal with that relationship. No, says Jesus. Leave your gift there. Right there. It's emphatic in the original. First, go and be reconciled, and then come and offer your gift. Now, we don't offer gifts to God at altars, so this illustration and the impact of it might be a bit lost on us. But you can imagine an analogous altar scene in the church here. Think of a wedding. When we have a wedding here, many of you will know, we face up that way. The groom's waiting up at that end. The Norman door opens. The red carpet is laid. The guests are there. A silence falls. Everyone rises. The bride comes in. She's holding her father's arm. She begins to walk up the aisle. The groom's waiting in anticipation. And then suddenly it comes into her head, oh no, that relationship. What do you think Jesus might say to her? Leave him there at the altar. First, go and be reconciled. And then come and offer your gift. And every bone in our body thinks, no, don't be ridiculous, Jesus, if I can put it that way. What would my mother-in-law think? You can't do that. But Jesus says, this is serious. We need a redefinition of righteousness as well as a redefinition of sin. True righteousness seeks restoration of relationship, even when that's costly. It's not transactional, waiting for favors before we start, but it's transformative, operating on a principle of grace. And this is the righteousness that Jesus says we have to have if we're to enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, I don't know, it may be that you've come here tonight already very conscious of a relationship with your brother or sister, perhaps literally a family member, someone at school, at work, at college. That's not right. Maybe that relationship's been a burden on your heart all day. Or perhaps even as I've been speaking just now, something has come into your head and you thought, yeah, that relationship's not right. Well, let me first say to you, don't leave. When Jesus says, leave, I think he's doing what he often seems to do here in the Sermon on the Mount. He's using the rhetorical device of hyperbole. It's a bit like later on when he says, to stop yourself sinning, cut your hand off or gouge out your eye, okay? Whoever's preaching on that in a couple of weeks will tell you that's not what he wants you to do. And I don't think he would have you leave now. No, stay and see if there's not some word of grace for you here. We need a word of grace, don't we? We need a word of grace because we've got a problem. We've seen that by Jesus' definition of sin, we're sinners. By Jesus' definition of righteousness, we are not righteous. So let's see finally that Jesus urges reconciliation with God as a way, as the way out of this problem. Are we starting to see, I wonder, that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gives us an ethic that's so wonderful and so beautiful that we can never hope to perfectly fulfill it ourselves in this life. Standards too high. By Jesus' definition of sin, we're sinners. By his definition of righteousness, we're not righteous. But don't you want to live like this? You hear about true righteousness. Don't you hunger and thirst for it? When Jesus' word shows you the depth of your own sin, don't you grieve? Don't you mourn? If you do, the last word this evening is going to be a word of blessed hope for you. If you don't, well, the last word this evening is going to be a word of warning to you. See, there may well be someone here this evening who thinks, well, I've heard what Jesus says, but Jesus doesn't know about the relationships I've had to go through. And frankly, I can't forgive that person. I don't want reconciliation. I'm going to carry on as I've been. Or perhaps someone else has heard what Jesus has said, and maybe you're thinking, I'm just glad I'm not like those hateful, spiteful, scornful people over there. If either of those is you, then Jesus' words have not drawn from you a hunger and thirst for righteousness or a sorrow, a mourning for sin. And that's why these last words will be of warning. Take a look at what I mean. We're in the last two verses
of today's reading, 25 and 26. I won't read it, I'll let you scan it through. Now, on the surface, this little scenario looks like just another illustration of the importance of making peace with other people. This time, the scenario is slightly different. You're a debtor, okay, so you owe something to someone. And your adversary, the one you owe something to, is going to take you to court. So it's going to be better for you to settle out of court, an out-of-court settlement before you get there. Jesus says, you should be settling matters, literally making friends with him as soon as possible. That's good for you because you won't get punished. This is a good principle, isn't it? It underlines Jesus' point about true righteousness and seeking reconciliation. As far as you're able, get right with other people, even if the other person is your enemy or your adversary, rather than your brother or sister, as it is in this one. It seems quite clear, but there are just a few hints that there's something more going on, something deeper, something under the surface. First of all, if this is just another example, it doesn't seem to add very much to the example we've already had. This time round, you're the one who's at fault, you've done something wrong, of course you should be seeking reconciliation. Second, Jesus says in verse 26, truly I say to you. When Jesus says, truly I say to you, you know he's got something important in mind. It's like these words should be printed in bold. And finally, this scenario, unlike almost all the other scenarios in chapter 5, isn't an if scenario. It's not if such and such happens, then do this. Jesus just seems to sort of assume that all of his hearers will find themselves in some kind of situation like this. Here's what I think is going on here. Jesus' hearers, and that includes all of us hearing his word, have seen that by Jesus' definition of sin, we're sinners. By his definition of righteousness, we're not righteous. And by definition, then, we're in danger of judgment, which is imminent. We're on the way to the place of judgment, and the punishment for our guilt under God's just sentence will be heavy. The punishment, Jesus has told us, is Gehenna, hell. And it's not like we can pay off the debt. The debt's too large. Well, in this predicament, Jesus tells us to make friends quickly with our adversary. It's a warning. The Bible's full of warnings from God. Warnings that are, at the same time as they're warnings, also invitations. Invitations to return to God, to repent, to turn round, to come back to him, to restore relationship with him. Listen, for example, to these words from Joel chapter 2. If you've been studying in Roots this term, you'll know them well. Even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting and weeping and mourning. Rend your heart and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he's gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, and he relents from sending calamity. See, the warning here that calamity may come is fused with a hint of hope. And so do you hear, finally, that word of blessed hope for those who are truly sorry for their sin and who hunger and thirst for true righteousness. See, the implication of Jesus' illustration is that if we become friends with or are reconciled to the one who had reason to bring a charge against us, God, well, then that charge might be dropped and we might be spared punishment. Praise God that his word to us is always like that. Right back in the Old Testament, as the law was given, the sacrificial system made provision right there for the lawbreaker that he or she might be reconciled to God. It's like that here. In the Sermon on the Mount as well. Remember how Jesus began the sermon. Blessed are the poor in spirit. His blessing right there for those who recognize their sin and cry out to God in their poverty. Jesus says the kingdom of heaven belongs to the poor in spirit. He doesn't say how that works. He just lays it down as a great principle. And so I think we might paraphrase Jesus in verses 25 and 26. Be reconciled to your fellow man or woman. But more important than that, be reconciled to God. Jesus doesn't tell us here how we can be reconciled to God, but he presumes that we may be. It's not as if we could pay God back.
And yet it seems from what Jesus says that there's a way, there must be a way, that our debt to God can be paid. You see, that the Sermon on the Mount's high standard of righteousness must mean, that our right standing with God must ultimately depend on the grace of the one whose standard it is, Jesus himself. And in Jesus himself, we find that grace. Jesus was the only man who ever lived without hate. He never committed murder, revenge, elimination, jealousy. Even in his heart, these were desires that the Lord didn't know, even though he was tempted in every way, just as we are. But he was himself hated. People of his day were filled with desires against him of revenge, elimination, jealousy. We want what he's got. We want him out the way. We want to get him back. We hate him. So they had him tried and scourged and crucified, even though he was perfectly innocent. They handed him over to punishment. The Bible tells us, amazingly, that this handing over happened by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. It was, in the book of Acts, God himself who handed over Jesus to his enemies. And this is the basis for reconciliation with God that Jesus points forward to here. Christ died, suffered and died for sins. The righteous, Jesus. For the unrighteous, you and me, to bring you to God. And what's more, the forgiving grace of God in Jesus has transformative power. God gives his people a new heart so that we turn away from sin more and more and live more and more in line with that perfect righteousness that should characterize subjects of God's kingdom. And so we can go out from here as recipients of his grace and live out this kingdom ethic in our own lives in the week to come. Forgiven our past sins, by the power of the Holy Spirit, we can fight against the anger, the contempt, the abuse that are in our hearts. Instead of being pregnant with evil, we can be pregnant with righteousness in the grace of God, giving birth in due time to true holiness and true righteousness. Don't you want to live like that?